Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Robert Maudsley casually walked into the cell of another inmate who was sleeping on his bunk face down. A savage rage quickly took over, and Maudsley started stabbing the back of the man's head. There was blood, pieces of brain, and chunks of hair flying in a fury. After the man went limp, Maudsley grabbed the man's head and held it in both palms and started to smash it against the walls of the cell, so hard that the plaster began to fall off the ceiling. Nurses and guards had to watch on, not being able to get into the cell, hearing the victim's head crack each time it was smashed against the wall. After Maudsley finished with the attack, he sat the limp body up against the bed, got down on his knees, and started to eat chunks of the brain with his homemade knife. Robert Maudsley was dubbed Hannibal the Cannibal on account of his thirst for eating the brains of his victims. He is one of the most interesting and thought-provoking murderers in prison. He will be housed in a bulletproof cage in the basement of Wakefield Prison, England, where Britain holds its most savage, high-profile convicts. He is known to be such a danger to others, even inmates. He lives in a specially designed cell that doesn't allow him any contact with anyone, except for guards that slide his food through a small hole at the bottom of his cell. Robert Maudsley is deemed to be the most dangerous prisoner in Britain. Even though he only killed one person outside of prison, his remaining victims were claimed while incarcerated. This book reviews Maudsley's life from his tormented childhood, his rage-filled murder outside of prison, and the planned torturous murders of three convicted pedophiles. The book that we're featuring this evening is Hannibal, the Cannibal, the true story of Robert Maudsley, with my special guest journalist, author, and radio co-host, Alan R. Warren. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Alan R. Warren.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you once again, Alan, for coming on and presenting us with such a bizarre and unusual tale, Hannibal the Cannibal. Always gets people interested when you mention cannibalism for some reason. So let's just get to this. Tell us a little bit about Robert Maudsley. He was born in June 1953 and in Liverpool. Tell us about the living conditions, his parents, Robert and Jean, and his siblings. Tell us a little bit about the family life, and before you talk about them being placed into adoption.
Well, he was definitely one of those that had a rough childhood. They were in Liverpool, but the south part, which is Toxteth. That is an area where there's a lot of social housing for World War II families and relocated immigrants and stuff. So it's a pretty poor area and run down.
Right.
Now, he was one of 12 kids, so there was a lot of kids in the family, but not a good upbringing. He ended up in an orphanage, I think, three times in his young life, and once he was taken away by social services. So it was kind of a poor upbringing. He claims that his father would beat him with a pole, with sticks, even a rifle, a 22 caliber. And he also claims that he would be locked in his room for months at a time. He also claimed that his father had raped him. So in his claims or explanations of his young life, it was pretty struggled right from the get-go. Like I said, in and out of all sorts of different orphanages and a Catholic church, and it was a pretty rough start.
You write that before he was two, and this has to add to his psychological background and makeup, before he was two, his parents had placed Robert and three of his siblings in a Roman Catholic orphanage, or they actually not placed them, they were taken due to claims of neglect, the parental neglect. So this was Robert, Paul, Kevin, and his sister Brenda, and they lived at this Nazareth house for, you write, to almost 6 or 7 years. But they said they were claimed they were treated well by authorities. This is a new one for true crime listeners. They were treated well by authorities at the orphanage, and they had a pretty good family bond, according to them, to their reports. And then the parents brought them back home. And you say that Robert was especially targeted by the abusive father. You say not only rape, but beatings and sexual abuse, but he seemed to be especially targeted from his father for abuse. What's next for Robert Maudsley at a young age? What does he do and what does he resort to?
Yeah, you know, it is true. They did say that they really enjoyed the one orphanage and had bonds and stuff. And even his brother made the claim that when the parents would come visit them, he felt like they were strangers. They were just people that they knew nothing about. So it was a totally different lifestyle for all of them. But by the time Robert was 16, he decided to head to London, you know, got away from home and went to the big city. And he ended up living, you know, on the street and doing drugs and getting involved in life as a rent boy. So he would sell himself for sex to men with money. And he continued doing that for a few years. And during that time, he overdosed. He attempted suicide. He ended up in rehab. Life was not any better there. He was just on his own in a big city and had control over the money he was making. So there was no more parents or orphanage to decide where he'd eat or where he'd live or sleep or who he'd be with. So it wasn't getting any better. It was just continuing how it was at home, but he was on his own.
You write that he was free by 1973 in that he was in and out of various hospitals, but you say that he was free by 1973 and again working as a prostitute, rent boy. And then he meets up with a person named John Farrell. Tell us about this meeting and what happens.
Well, John Farrell was had recently divorced from his wife, and John Farrell had a bisexual tendency, so that caused a lot of problems in his marriage. So he was recently single, and so he would go down to the main streets of London and pick up rent boys, and Robert was one of them. And he liked Robert because not only his looks, his body frame, but his mannerisms and his behavior. So he really enjoyed being with Robert, and they probably were together almost every week for about 5 to 6 months. John Farrell would pick him up whenever he got back from work. He was kind of a laborer construction person, so he would go away on jobs. Now the one time in 1973, probably there, I don't know how many dates they'd already had by then, quite a few. He picked him up and took him home, and this time it was different. After they started being together for a little while, John got up and pulled out of his drawer a big pile of pictures of younger boys, and they were in different sexual positions, and they were being they were being hard to describe. In the pictures, they were being forced to do things. It was the pictures portrayed that they were being raped. I'm not sure that they were real rapes or real bondage pictures, but that's what they portrayed. Now, according to Maudsley, he was forced to look at them, and he was John Farrell was trying to have sex with him involving these pictures, and that it was too close to home, and I think it brought him back to the time where he was being raped and assaulted by his father and being attacked, and he had a real real psychological problem dealing with this, and so he blew a stack. He went crazy, and he ended up attacking John Farrell and killing him.
Right.
So, and of course, that's how he first got arrested for a murder and was put on trial.
Yeah, you talk about that he was arrested, but he was deemed unfit. Considered unfit to stand trial and sent to the, infamous Broadmoor Hospital for the criminally insane. Now, we fast forward, unless we can talk about Broadmoor Hospital, but tell us about Broadmoor Hospital, where he is placed, and then 1977, what happens with Robert and a fellow inmate, David Cheeseman.
Right. What I can say about Broadmoor is a very strict, structured, well-run hospital for insane criminals. So these are all people that have committed crimes. So this isn't just for people that are insane, period. You've had to have done something. So he was placed in there. Now, I want to bring up this because this is very important later in the story. And I think it's a part that you don't want to miss. When he talked about how much he enjoyed his time in the orphanage, and this relates to this, the hospital. He loved being in the hospital. He loved checking himself in as well in his time as a rent boy. I think he found life outside of a hospital uncontrollable, and he felt tortured, with his parents, with his family in London, being a rent boy. All of outside life was just wild to him, and he couldn't seem to rein it in. And it cost him to do a lot of drugs. When he was in the hospitals, he felt very at peace, at ease, and he felt like his life was structured, and he seemed to really enjoy that lifestyle. So going to Broadmoor was something that he really liked, and he wanted to stay there. He did not want to go anywhere else. And I think that's important to say because, according to him, throughout the story, you'll hear that crimes that he committed, a lot of times he used that as his original plan of why he did it like that. That was kind of his goal, was to get to a hospital. So it's a bizarre way of looking at things. But as you go through and if you read the book, you'll read in parts where he sort of talks about that a lot,
Now, despite what you're saying about that he was at peace or more so anyway at peace in this hospital, 1977, and there's a person named David Francis. Now, Robert and fellow inmate David Cheeseman know David Francis as a convicted pedophile, but also you write that they had said that he had sexually assaulted, this David Francis had sexually assaulted a friend of theirs. Now, I say, despite this peace that had overcome Robert Maudsley, what does he and David Cheeseman do one day in 1977?
Well, yeah, and in reference to the peace, too, I think in his mind he thought he had life in control when he was in the hospital. So it didn't mean that he didn't want to kill. I don't want you to think that. What I'm saying is, see, he had a real issue with the first person killed and what got him into the hospital, John Farrell, because of the abuse of children. This David Francis was the same way. He was a convicted pedophile. So they became aware of him because of raping a friend, but it was his pedophilia that really drew and drove Maudsley into wanting to kill him, wanted him to punish him. So so when the two of them, Cheeseman and Maudsley, grabbed Francis, they had pre-planned this, and they had taken apart little pieces of a radio so they could plug the lock of the office. So what they did was they grabbed him and dragged him into the office and broke the lock off so that people couldn't get in. So the nurses and the few guards there and a lot of the inmates could see in and could hear what was going on, but they couldn't get in. So they had sort of preset this up. And so what they did was they tied him and they tortured him and they made him in great deal of pain and scream out and yell. And they did this for about 8 to 9 hours. And then they garroted him, or Maudsley himself garroted him on the throat. So that's how they killed him. So the whole intention was to make him feel punished, to torture him and to make him feel a pain for what he inflicted into the kids when he was convicted pedophile. So that was his goal behind that. He wasn't, it's just really hard to explain in that way. I'm just trying to put you in his mind of, he thought he was doing something good.
Yeah. You talk about this, the horror of these people, the nurses, the guards, and the other inmates, listening to this man's screams for almost the entire 9 hours. And you say they were punching, kicking, and cutting him with their homemade knives they made from this radio and these plastic spoons that they had. And this was the other thing they'd had. They had plastic, known plastic knives, but they had plastic spoons. But if they fashioned them a certain way, cut them down the middle, they'd have the equivalent of a knife in prison terms. What happens with them, with the David Francis, after they garrote him and make sure that he's absolutely dead? What else happens after that concerning Robert Maudsley?
Well, you know, with that, they were both arrested and charged with murder. And this time what they did was they give them a criminal trial. So they were both convicted and held accountable. So in the UK, he wasn't found, criminally insane, like their version of that. So the big change was, this was the second killing that he had done. So what they ended up doing was sending him to a regular prison. And of course, they didn't just choose a regular average prison. They put him in a Category A prison, which is for the killers, the worst killers. And actually, the people in Wakefield are usually the most notorious. They are the worst of the worst. And in some cases, they are just the most popular. People that have garnered a lot of media attention are also put in there. So it is the the highest and the roughest prison. And so he was sentenced to there in July of 1978, and he absolutely hated it. And he just couldn't take it. He hated the life there, and he wanted to go back to Broadmoor. He wanted to go back to the hospital where he felt, in his mind, at peace.
Let's go back, though, because what we have to determine is he comes to Wakefield with this reputation, with these nicknames, with this mythology behind him, this unusual event that happened with this murder. And when I asked you what happened next, and we talked about they were arrested, but we didn't talk about the horror, the very first thing, that the thing that cemented him into true crime history. What else was done, and what did the guards find, and where does he get this reputation from?
Oh, okay. Well, you know, during the murder, a lot of the prison guards and a lot of the nurses and other inmates were able to see it as well as hear it. And so what happened was, how do I say this? He would get accused of being like eating parts of the body, and that came from one of the guards, and you know, so they ended up calling him what, Spoons, I believe, was the first nickname, and then Blue, and it was never confirmed, but what it was when he when you were reading the opening description, you know, the head was sliced open, and a spoon was placed into the brain of the victim, and one of the guards had claimed that he saw Maudsley eating the brain, but Maudsley denied that claim and said that what he did was he did this because he wanted to be found insane.
And sent that back to Broadmoor Hospital, obviously.
Yeah, right. So because he thought that makes him nuts, it makes him insane. If he does something like that, he hasn't got his right mind. So it's not something that would you would put a person in prison for. So his intention was to kill this man and make it look like he was insane while killing him and eating the brain. And so this sort of would send him back to a mental institute like Broadmoor. He's not going to be kept in a prison.
Right. Now, you talk about that he's sentenced to life imprisonment and he's sent to Wakefield. And he has this reputation. Now, this is July 1978. This is only not much more than a year later. You write that he started the day by making paper coffins and placing human hair inside them. And he targets someone named Salney Darwood. Now, tell us a little bit about Salney Darwood and what happens that morning between them.
Yeah, well, Darwood was another convicted, you know, pedophile and rapist. And this was, again, a target of his no matter what. And so Sal Darwood was a 46-year-old. And he was one of many that Maudsley had targeted. So it isn't just a random act. But he would, in the morning after the workout, he would go out looking for people, and he tried to lure a few of the people that he had targeted into his cell, you know, with different reasons, you know, drugs or who knows. Sal Darwood, he was able to get back into a cell. We're not sure exactly why. But Maudsley quickly stabbed him and in the back and the neck, the head. When he fell on the floor, he was bleeding. He rolled him over and then he stabbed him again in the chest and the face. So he really, you know, it was a real rage killing. Then to finish it all off, he had strings that he had hidden under his mattress, kind of like shoestring styles. And so he wrapped it around his neck and he held it for several minutes because he wanted to make sure he was dead. And so after that, of course, he tied it into a bow, you know, like a, you know, for a string around his neck. And they rolled the body under the bunk, washed his hands, and then went back out into general population as if nothing happened.
You write that he is looking for other victims. He's not satiated by that one murder. He's asking other people to come to his cell under different pretenses, but people are not coming to the cell. Then he finds someone he never met before named Bill Roberts, 56 years old, and he's in his cell sleeping with his face down. So what does Robert Maudsley do now?
Well, it was his opportunity. He was, you know, later in letters he talked about this as his goal was to get back to Broadmoor Mental Institute. So, but while he was going to do something to put himself back in the hospital, he was selecting people he wanted dead. They didn't deserve to live, and it was all about the child abuse. So it seemed like his intention was, I'm going to take out as many of these pedophiles as possible in a grotesque way and get put back into a hospital by doing it. So so that's his mindset. So when he come across Roberts was sleeping in a cell, like he said, so it was a perfect opportunity. And he was a 56-year-old that was, again, another convicted pedophile and killer. And so he was sleeping, so it was perfect. He was able to get right into the cell without him hearing. And he, again, started stabbing him in the back of the head, turning him over and stabbing him in the front, the face, the chest, the whole works. And he would do it. And the beginning statement when you were reading is part of the first part of the book, you know, where I was just like stabbing him so harsh that the lifeless body's just laying there and it's twitching and all sorts of parts of the flesh are coming out and blood, and it's flying all through the room. And then he took the head and he grabbed kind of the skull part, and he would crack it against the wall and then the floor, because he wanted to break it open. So it was like a huge mess that he made. And so eventually, again, it was the same thing. He turned the body around and kind of had the head laying on the floor. And you just have to see it. At this particular person, there was over 40 stab wounds throughout his body that they could count. So this was rage. He really hated this person, not because of a lifetime of knowing him, but because of what he had done and how it related to him in his own childhood and being raped and going through that torture. So that's kind of how that went, you know. And he ended up just washing his hands and wiping his knife, and he went into the guard's office, and he placed his makeshift knife on the table, and apparently he said, "It looks like it'll be too short on roll call. And smiled. And so that's how callous he was toward this.
Now, as a result of this horror, of these murders that this person has done, what does the prison decide to do? Did they decide to send him to Broadmoor Hospital? What did they decide to do?
No, actually, he wasn't going to get what he wanted. This whole series, he just ended up getting convicted of two more murders. Reality was, they looked at him worse this time. Instead of sending him for a treatment and sending him to a hospital, they were going to give him more life sentences and keep him in a more strict manner, because they don't think a hospital is going to help him.
Right. You write that he was deemed unfit to associate with any other inmates due to their safety and his own, because he was still suicidal, due to their safety, and was placed in the solitary confinement unit. However, they had to designed a special cell with two cells. Maybe you can explain this incredible cell that you have a photo of in the book, Hannibal the Cannibal, by the way. Tell us about this cell that they construct.
Yeah, so they did it in the basement of Wakefield Prison, and it was sort of so if you've seen the Hannibal the Cannibal sort of movie series and Silence of the Lambs and different things, and you sort of right. see how they have a cell down in a basement, and it's very confining, and you know, they feed them through the little thing, and they can all watch them, and it's similar to that, only there's two of them. They actually created a double cell, and they would keep the worst two, or at the moment, I guess, or at the month, that were in the death row or, you know, total confinement. And Maudsley's always one of them. So this is a very small, I don't know how to describe it. It's like a 5 by 4 meter, almost square cell. And, you know, the unit has bulletproof window, it's shatterproof. It just has that look. Silence of the Lambs really took their imaging of that cell from that. You know, inside he's got the little teeny weeny table with one chair. It looks like a kiddie table, made from pressed cardboard, and it's on a pure cement slab. Toilet and the sink are both bolted to that cement slab. You know, and when you hear about how the conditions are, this is one thing Maudsley complains about quite often, is that with that, the toilets are always backed up, there's sewer all over the place, really stinks. You know, it's just things like that. It's the same thing as they, you know, when you say the guards pass the food through that little slot, it's at the bottom of the floor, right where the waste runs off and everything. So it's very unsanitary. It's not a nice setup. And he's put in there for 23 hours a day, and he's permitted 1 hour, escorted to the yard with no less than 6 guards. So it's kind of how they show it too on the movie, in that sense. And he's not allowed to communicate with anybody else or talk to anybody in the yard. It's solitary 1 hour in the yard. So it's a pretty traumatic place to be. And I'm not sticking up for him or anything. I'm not trying to feel sorry for him. It is very intense.
You write that nobody thought about him soon after this. So in, you know, early 80s, no one thought of him for quite a while, till there was a series in, or articles in British media. How does this come about, and what kinds of things were the media interested in writing about regarding Robert Maudsley?
Well, media is media, right? And so they have different intentions. For the most part, I think at first their intention was to talk about someone that would eat other body parts and would eat brains. And, you know, it's kind of a really scary, and it's a good story. And it draws people in, right? Initially, I think the first media person wanted to just do an interview for a book. Initially, I think that was the very first contact they had with him. So that was kind of the idea of it. It was more about what they could sell.
You write too that there was a a doctor that had tried for two or three years, a Dr. Bob Johnson, had tried for two or three years to be able to go to Wakefield and be able to interview him. And finally, he's able to interview him and then speaks to him, discusses, interviews him, and treats him for another two or three years. You provide in the book a lot of that information about this Dr. Bob Johnson and the kinds of things that he concluded after speaking with Robert Maudsley.
Well, again, I think this is kind of where we get the idea. When he spent all that time and he wrote kind of a perspective of what Maudsley was about, and you get the real feeling out of Maudsley. He's very smart, very well spoken, well read, even though he's not been formally educated. And you know, it's just you get the whole idea of his mental health and how he thinks about punishing and killing the pedophiles and about his life. And he's also very very vocal about the conditions that he's kept in, along with the other prisoners as well. And he's used a lot of his notoriety to try and get that information out there. So a lot of the comments and a lot of stuff I put in from that, it tells you about a day in the life, about the breakfast in his cage and the keepers you know, the sour milk and all of the things that he complains about in his life. You know, it's just one of those situations. It's a tough one to talk about.
You're right, there are some similarities in the media looked at this as well, that he has, as you write, a near genius IQ and that he loves classical music, and that was one of his complaints, is why can't I listen to beautiful music? Or so I guess at one time part of the privileges that he had denied were things like books and television, and that situation, as you write, has changed. And you also had correspondence, and or at least you write about the correspondence and the contact that Robert Maudsley has with his nephew now that he's in prison.
Oh, yeah, Robert Maudsley and his nephew, now, Gavin. Gavin's probably one of the most vocal about Maudsley and about the conditions and just the whole situation that he's in. And as far as things like that, you know, there's a real, real big problem about Maudsley in the UK about the complaints. And should we allow killers like that to be having things like playing video games and like Call of Duty, his favorite game on PlayStation? Should he be allowed to listen to music? Should he be allowed to enjoy the life that he has left? And this sort of is what has a lot of controversy, because some, of course, a lot of the people and government and media has said, well, yeah, we shouldn't treat them like animals. But then there's also the call and the people, the families of victims and around that feel betrayed. Of course, by the public or by the media and even the justice system, by allowing them to have more luxuries, as we would call them. So it's kind of, and Gavin's one of those that's very outspoken about the whole thing. He'll go to Sun Times, he goes to all the media as much as he can, you know. And that's, it's also brought on other high profilers as well. You know, Charles Bronson probably being the most popular of the killers over there. And when Bronson assaulted a guard, you know, what came out of that was he said that it was because of the stress and the mental anguish of the way they're treated and housed. And he wanted Maudsley, Robert Maudsley, to be a witness toward it because of his outspokenness toward all the problems in prisons like that.
Yeah, and you write, too, that at least it seems to me that there seems to be a lot of sense to what he said to a psychiatrist, that look at this was a hatred for my father who molested me, and then it was triggered by again the first murder and feral, and so then it seems to be to the media and people looking at this that these murders, and there seems to be some sympathy that these murders weren't so bad because they were pedophiles, they were convicted pedophiles, so not so bad in terms of who he killed. But people forget that that there are still the victims' families, and they're not focused on any of that. They're focused on this, what this killer has done and the impact on their family, and yet the government and people like Dr. Bob Johnson, who said after 3 years or so, well, I was about three-quarters of the way through his treatment, that was very, very encouraging. So some people are very enraged by that, that they would even consider psychiatric treatment to a person that's never, ever going to get out of prison anyway, and is so dangerous that they have to customize and build a separate cell system, a cell for him and people like Charles Bronson next to him, so dangerous that they can't be among other dangerous criminals.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that kind of goes with, I think, the atmosphere and society right now in the UK and the US and even parts of Canada. You see a lot of this more, I don't know, you say Trumpish sort of vocalization of things, like when you know, it's a killer, too bad, like, you know, and there's this real nonchalantness. So it's kind of got a mix. It seems like you go one way or the other way with this. It's a tough call, because you get the, you know, and I will say, and look at when we talk about putting him in a special prison built for him and stuff. I don't know. Is that realistic? Is he really that dangerous? Is he the worst of the worst, or is a lot of it just talk, gossip, and blown out of proportion? He's a rather meek person. He's not a big, aggressive Hulk by any means. You know, not taking away the crimes he committed, but in my eyes, there's some people in that prison, and we're talking several people that have done far, far worse and that are much more threatening than Maudsley. And I think that he was placed there all on reputation more than actual crimes. Of course, that's just my thinking, but there's certainly a lot worse out there. And they're not in near as strict incarceration as he is.
You're right, and we'll talk about that right now, because this is part of the thing where there's a certain mythology. Despite there being inmates, nurses, and guards, witnesses to these murders, and the idea that there's a spoon and the reputation of the spoon being in the brain, there was an autopsy on the very first David Francis, the first murder inside prison, pedophile David Francis. What was the conclusion of that autopsy in regards to Robert Maudsley having eaten some of the brain? Tell us about that.
Well, you see, that leads to the big question. You know, did he really eat the victim's brain with a spoon? And did he really do as they said? And the autopsy really kind of showed us that it wasn't what he did, and I think that the whole idea of that, it just kind of shows you how things blow out of proportion. Just people hear things, their imagery of what's going on, and then what he wanted to portray to them. He wanted them to think that he did. He did want that. And that was his intention, but that's not what he really did. He was not the cannibal as people. He wasn't like the Jeffrey Dahmer, where he was eating parts of the body. This isn't true. The idea was, in his mind, portraying this person that's nuts, that's totally insane, that shouldn't be in a prison, that should be in a hospital like this. So, you know, from his point of view, that's what he wanted. And so he went along with it. And of course, then with the guards and with the other nurses and other inmates talking about the rampage, and it gave him a reputation far more than what he ever was or did, not justifying anything by any means. But what we're talking about here is we're talking about saying this man likes to eat bodies. He'll kill you and eat your brains and do all this stuff. And that's all, you know, good for the movies and for the shows. But the truth is that's not what happened. And that's not what he did. Not saying, again, I don't want you to think that it's okay what he did. But it's one of those that's way blown out of proportion. And he's made out to be much worse by reputation than what he really, really is. Not that he should be out by any means.
Then again, you know, I understand what you're saying. And then, of course, when we opened the show, I said, because cannibalism is involved, we are especially, as viewers and listeners, especially interested in that aspect of it. With this, it created and backfired for this person that wrongfully was placed in a hospital in the first place. If you just look at the description of the murder itself and what he probably said to police, that just the outline of it, it would seem that that would be certainly murder, and he shouldn't have been placed in a hospital in the first place. From there, he was misguided. Despite his near genius IQ, he was misguided in the idea. You know, three times he did murders at trying to go back to that hospital in vain, and just added to his own discomfort and persecution, as he claims, in prison. But justifiably, there may be more dangerous people. And you write that in Wakefield they have about 60 people that will never ever get out of prison. Unlike the U.S. and Canada as well, there are very few, people that would be deemed never to be released. Absolutely, that's a guarantee. And like Britain, there are only so many people that have a no parole eligibility whatsoever, no ability to ever get out of prison, and they are in Wakefield. So maybe not exclusively in Wakefield, but 60 of the worst are in Wakefield. And this person that smashed people's brains open to be able to create this mythology that he may have eaten those people's brains, he still had the capacity to kill these people two in one day or more, and they just calmly walk into a guard's station smiling and say, here you go, here's the knife, you're going to be a couple short. He's cracking jokes. So he's certainly a psychopathic killer capable of murder, rage murder. So, yeah, exaggerated.
Yeah, don't get me
he's
wrong.
He's exaggerated, yeah. But this certainly is one of the most shocking killers I've ever read about, I would think.
You know, and I think in his mind, you know, it's there in one of the letters to the doctors, you know, and he talked about how he thought killing pedophiles was okay. He was doing, the world a service. And there's plenty of people out there that agree with him. A lot of people out there, you see the rage, castrate them and all this stuff. So he did have that. And his mind, he thought he was doing something good. And in fact, when he killed the two on that one day before he gave up, he wanted to kill a handful. He wanted to kill more than two. He wanted to kill quite a few. And he had mentioned how he thought for sure they were going to send him back to the mental hospital. So before he was taken to the mental hospital, he had to clear the deck of as many pedophiles as he could. So in his mind, he had a job to do. He better do it before they send him out of that prison. So he had a total different idea behind him. And as far as the eating of the brain, that was just kind of the symbolization that he would do that. And they were, oh, this guy is nuts. because of the way people talk and the way it grows, and all of a sudden, oh, this guy's nuts, this guy's crazy, this is insane. So for him, it was just more of a show. And like I said, I don't think any of it makes it right, but I think what's happened is from the outside, we've totally misjudged who he is and what he did. And in either case, he should be put away for life. That's not a question. It's just, you know, and you're right. I mean, in itself of just thinking that way and doing a display as if you were eating someone's brains is enough to make you think, well, yeah, we don't want him out teaching school tomorrow.
No. You write about a Paul Harrison, a former detective of over 40 years experience in the British judicial system. They call him the British Mindhunter. 25 years profiling. He met with Robert Maudsley. What was his conclusions? What were his thoughts about after meeting him?
Well, you know, when you get profilers like that, and like Harrison, you get some of the ones from the Mindhunters as people see and stuff like that. They tend to do things from a more clinical point of view. So when he talks about a lot of things about Maudsley, he's talking more about actions and reactions and profiling why people do things and how they select, you know, their victims, and they profile what they're getting out of it. And I don't think there's any surprises there when it comes to that.
Now, there are people that have expressed, again, sympathy for Robert Maudsley in terms of the treatment of him in prison. And this sympathy is, some people think it was misguided, but he does have this PlayStation, and he does have, again, the ability to write letters and have visits and phone calls. So what would people believe, again, and like for the government to do, for the state to do, for this person as he gets older and, as you say, probably getting less harmful as time goes on due to his physical condition?
Well, you know, that's, you know, there's people that, you know, how do you get into it without being too political? But there's a lot of people on one side of the spectrum that want to try to rehabilitate, try to make their life more normal in that respect, you know, like TVs, PlayStations, music, all that sort of stuff. And, of course, then you've got a total other wing out that wants to these people should be killed, if anything. They want the death penalty. We seem to be going to the two extremes right now, and I think the truth is probably, or what it should be, is probably somewhere closer to the middle. You know, because if as a nation we've decided, just like the UK, that we're not going to kill our criminals, then we're not going to kill them. Should they have a good life? Probably not. But what do we do with them? You know, like what? It's kind of one of those questions that's really hard to answer, because the closer you are to the victim, or to another victim of another crime in sort of a same sort of situation, it's painful to see that criminal, you know, on a PlayStation. It's hard to see them getting treats or getting things that are considered kind of a good or a luxury in life. And meanwhile, your family member, whoever that was, or friend or whoever was the victim, doesn't have a life anymore. Their kids, the family. So it's really a, where do you draw that line? Like, what do you call luxury and what do you call, you know, necessity? And when he does complain about things like the sour milk and things like that, and that in itself, that's true. That sure is kind of, you know, if we're going to keep them alive, the nation said we can't kill them. Okay. So here we go, a person. Do we give them sour milk and bad food and all of these other things? You know, let the feces. You know, his toilet's backed up and he's got, you know, all that laying across the floor where they slide the food in, and that is that okay? And does it say more about us by allowing that to happen and how we do these things to them? Or is it, you know what I mean? It's really, where's punishment and where is compassion? You know, it's a question that I think we'll always be fighting with. And it's going to swing all sorts of directions depending on society at the time and the government, I guess. But I don't know. I do think there are bad things that we do to people like that, and I think that it only makes things worse. You know, this isn't making him better. Not that we ever think we would, but it makes him more of a challenge for the people that are in charge of securing him, like the guards. They have to deal with more of an unstable person and even in a worse condition than they got him. So,
well, the thing is that you talk about this as a topic here in Canada, and I don't know, to a lesser degree, a far lesser degree in the U.S. There is talk about the constitutionality of solitary confinement, especially over extended periods of time. But the question always people may have, like myself, is, well, why were they deemed necessary to be placed in solitary confinement? And when you get a case like this, that he's dangerous to other inmates, how many would he have killed? And then somebody's saying, well, we got to worry about the psychiatric, the psychological welfare of this person. And that's where people have a problem. Not in terms so much of money, but in terms of there's assumption that you can fix everyone. And obviously, this person is broken. So regardless, and so somebody's made the decision to put this person in solitary confinement. Like I say, in Canada, there's talk of that person in solitary confinement needs at least a few hours of other human contact in order to maintain a certain level of psychological health. So again, where does that end? And where does that... And so we've seen in Canada where a murderer is it's time served because they spent so much time in solitary confinement. And this is a little place like Thunder Bay, Ontario, where so much time in solitary confinement that charge was dealt with as time served. But why were they in that solitary confinement is the question. Alan?
No, you were cut out there. I didn't hear your question.
I just said, well, I really didn't have a question. I just made this comment that I think the solitary confinement is the question. Do we deal psychologically with a person like this that the only contact he has was probably another psychologically damaged person being Charles Bronson is in the adjoining cell with him, and then whatever contact he has with his nephew. So I think, like I said, in Canada, at this same time, in 2019, they're talking about the constitutionality of solitary confinement itself, psychologically welfare of these people. So you say,
yeah.
Where does that go?
Yeah.
I mean, this is where it's gone.
Yeah, and I think it's just going to be a fluid situation. I don't think you're going to have – it's going to go back and forth. I personally think that they would probably I think a majority of people would go with the death penalty. The problem is a lot of people don't have faith in the system, and there's just far too much attention and way too many wrongly convicted people that are getting out and that we're hearing about now. And I think it's scratching the surface. So if you can't get that right, how comfortable are you with killing people, you know? And so it's an endless battle, and I don't know what the answer is, actually. I really don't. I go back and forth myself, you know, because I've been working on a book, and I've been dealing with a lot of the family members this year of victims. So it becomes very hard when you hear what they go through when they have to go to parole every year and a half with a person that killed their family, you know. But you start to hear all these stories, you start thinking, wow, what is the answer?
Well, I mean, you're talking about a couple things here in terms of the death penalty can get it wrong. And it's not in every state that the death penalty is available and not the death penalty isn't carried out. So right there, an inherent not level, I don't know, playing field is not the expression, but and that they could get it wrong and that they have factually gotten it wrong means that the death penalty is something that's why we're not talking about it in this case. This case is, in Britain, they've said no death penalty. In Canada, said no death penalty. So solitary confinement is all that you can do if a person continues to murder in prison and you have no death penalty as an option to, I guess, not to necessarily stop this person, but this person as multiple murderer. So, and then the solitary confinement. But the idea that we're dealing with here is that this person, it seems inhumane, the treatment, and that's what he complains about, that's what his nephew complains about, is the inhumane treatment. This person had a horrible life. He'd just like to know how this occurred. And as you write in the book, it was 12 years before he had a haircut because even the barber was afraid to go near him, right?
Yeah. No, that's true. And that's what I mean. We're what do we consider, mandatory care? Like what items are something that we need to be doing and what items aren't? And it varies so much when you talk people to people. What they think they should get. And if anything, I think if you asked and took a poll of general population on what people think if a prisoner has to live in, if it's bad or, you know, if they've got a cushy life, I think most people think that prisoners lived in a really good situation in prison. I think there's a strong feeling that people get away with too much.
I think certainly you can talk to enough people that will emotionally not lash out, but they'll convey and express their opinions, which will be like, well, I'd kill them, I wouldn't spend a nickel on them. But if their child, relative, brother, sister, or family member was incarcerated, they would instantly be talking a different tune. They would be instantly fighting for those numerous appeals and the best of attorneys to be able to defend them. And then once they're incarcerated, they would certainly want their loved one. Most of these people, a lot of these people, still support their family member that's a killer or a rapist. I wouldn't say rapist, but definitely serious criminals like killers are supported very often by family members, and they would want them at that time, despite their initial opinion before, they would want them to be housed in humane conditions. So I'm all for humane conditions. I'm not for punishment once you're there. Jail, your conviction is punishment in itself. They don't need to administer other punishment. That's the sort of where corrections should be. The sentence is punishment enough. I think, I don't know for certain, but I can imagine, and I have said this before, if life in a cell is not good enough for those people seeking retribution, I say maybe you should visit there or find out more about that. I think certainly that they would not want to be there. They would certainly believe that that was punishment. And if that's what you want, that's what you got. And that's what you got with this person. He certainly, you can't do any more to a person than this. And if he has a PlayStation or if he gets a TV set, which is afforded most prisoners in most judicial systems in the first world, I would say that he is certainly entitled to it, despite the murders and the shocking behavior and the atrocities that nurses, guards, and other inmates had to witness at the hands of Robert Maudsley. But that's where I would stand on that. In terms of psychiatric treatment, I worry when you talk about this Bob Johnson, and he says, well, we were three-quarters of the way into terms of, he didn't say cure, but I'm afraid of psychologists and psychiatrists when they start have control of deciding who is fixed and who isn't.
Yeah. Yeah, that's always a problem. Yeah.
I want to thank you, Alan, for coming on and talking about Hannibal the Cannibal. It's been fascinating. The true story of Robert Maudsley. Tell us where they might be able to find other work of yours, and tell us a little bit about House of Mystery.
Oh, yeah, sure. I have a personal website, just alanrwarren.com. Of course, you can buy the books at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and any other bookstore that'll pick it up. And as far as House of Mystery, we kind of cover all mysteries in crime, science, cults, politics, kind of go over a lot of questions. It's Monday to Friday on KCAA 106.5 FM in Los Angeles. And you can also go to houseofmystery.com or the KCAA webpage and listen to the show.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, Alan. You're a very prolific author, and some of the most interesting cases in true crime you cover. Thank you very much. You have a great evening. Thank you once again for this interview. Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.
Good night.